DW, World in Progress. With Anca Rasper.
Welcome to the show. I'm Anca Rasper in Bonn, Germany. Freedom of thought and freedom of expression are human rights. But what about the language you choose to think and express yourself in? Well, according to the UN, being able to choose the language you want to use is a key part of these rights. And there are certainly plenty to choose from. There are almost 7,000 languages in the world, though the vast majority of them is under threat of dying out. We'll be hearing from Scotland and from the Pyrenees Mountains later in the show. But first, as the UN's International Year of Indigenous Languages draws to a close, let's take a closer look at the challenges endangered languages face and how we can protect them. Our reporter Loveday Wright has more.
You're probably hearing this language for the first time, and you're not alone. This is a song in Gorwa, a language spoken by just 15,000 people in northeastern Tanzania. It's just one of around 7,000 languages spoken in the world. And like many of those languages, it's at risk.
The majority of the indigenous languages are also endangered languages. I prefer to use the terms minority language and endangered language instead of indigenous language and endangered language, because you can have a minority language which is not endangered. For instance, think of Catalan in Catalonia is a minority language, but it's not endangered. But every endangered language is a minority language.
Vera Ferreira, a linguist who works with the Endangered Languages Documentation Programme at SOAS University of London, explains that it's not just a small number of speakers that makes a language endangered.
There is not one factor alone that describes an endangered language, but a group of factors that depends very strongly from the regional background, from the historical background, economical background, where the language is spoken.
Just under half of the world's languages are considered endangered.
There were always, in the history of the humankind, there were always languages that disappeared. This is a natural process that language die out, that other languages arise. This is an evolution. However, the process now in which languages are dying out is very quick at the moment. So we are losing languages very quickly. And the pressure from the outside world into these communities, economic pressure, the technological pressure, but also social pressure, is making these languages more vulnerable than they were before.
Vera Ferreira says digitalization is one reason for the rapid loss of language diversity.
Everybody wants to be connected to the digital world, and this is fair enough. But the problem is when not all the languages have the possibility or have the, I would say, the facilities to be present in the digital world. Some languages do not have things very basic like a keyboard where you can type your language in. So it's normal that people then switch to a major language in order to be able to be part of the digital world. I think one of the biggest challenges at the moment is the evolution in technology and digital communication.
So in a changing world, why should we protect languages that can't keep up?
It is part of our intangible cultural heritage, not only mine and yours, but from the world's. Language entails a lot of knowledge connected to particular words. For instance, think about botanical knowledge or knowledge related to fauna and flora that only exists in that particular language. And when I say it only exists in that particular language, I mean there's only ways to express that knowledge in the particular language, because if we use English to translate what they are saying, we don't have a specific concept for that. So there's a lot of diversity that gets lost when a language dies out.
In junior, talaga niya, pwede i-benta tiwa, ipolong tam yan.
Mm-mm. Etalo diyan.
I can give you the example of a language spoken in the Philippines, which is Northern Alta. Northern Alta is spoken by a group called Negritos in the Philippines, and they were considered one of the first inhabitants of the Philippines.
Oh.
Studies show that they arrived like 40,000 years ago in the Philippines. So researching these languages and the culture connected to those languages is also very important for us to understand the human prehistory.
These minority languages can hold the key to understanding more about who we are and help secure knowledge for the future. So the least we can do is listen.
The more openness towards this diversity will already help to start a dialogue. And I think what would be important is to have more dialogue, to make people more, to present this diversity to people, to make people more in contact with speakers of those languages. Which maybe sometimes you have speakers of these other languages around you and you don't know that they speak this minority language, right? So to have the languages presented in the first person is, I think it's one of the best ways to make people aware of it and then engage with the communities.
And that was linguist Vera Ferreira talking to Loveday Wright. And also thanks to Andrew Harvey and Alex Garcia Laguia for the recordings of the Garwa and Northern Alta languages you heard there. We'll be looking at two endangered European languages next. Europe might not be as linguistically diverse as Africa and Asia, but the continent still has a number of minority languages. In Scotland, for instance, while most people there speak English, a tiny proportion of the population still speak Scots Gaelic. The language goes as far back as the 4th century, but now, in 2019, there are concerns that it too is dying out. Jack Foster has this report.
If you were to go back to the Scotland of 1,000 years ago, you'd see a country whose culture, politics and geography was dominated by the Gaelic language. In today's Scotland, the sight of bilingual signage on roads, official buildings and police cars might lead you to believe that not much has changed, when, in fact, many here in Scotland now think the country's mother tongue is in a terminal decline. Kirsty MacDonald is a native Gaelic speaker from North Uist in the Western Isles.
My mum had moved to the island and learned Gaelic, and although she spoke it to us when we were very young, as we got older, she found it difficult to keep it up. So while my dad spoke it to us all the time and his extended family and my cousins, we perhaps had less of the language in the house than many around us. But as I grew older, I came to realise more and more just how important the language was and what an important part it played in my life.
At the last census, just over 1% of the population said they could speak Gaelic. At around 60,000 people, it's a drop of almost 75% over the last century. On top of that, the last generation of people to speak only Gaelic died out during the 70s and 80s.
In the Western Isles, it's still the majority of people still speak it, but it's declining pretty fast. When I was young, there was no provision. Gaelic medium education came in the 1980s, whereby people could be educated bilingually, so they would be immersed in Gaelic for the first 2 years and then educated bilingually. This has definitely helped the language. However, it's still declining, and it's in particular, it's still declining as a language in the home.
So despite a number of high-profile attempts to protect and promote the use of Gaelic in Scotland, such as Gaelic schooling, it seems to be making little impact on that decline in people speaking the language. Jim Whannell is Director of Education at Bosna Gaelic, the public body set up by the Scottish Government for the promotion of Gaelic.
There's mixed evidence. There's a lot of very, very positive news about Scottish Gaelic, the development of Gaelic medium education. particularly in the south of the country, in the urban centres, Glasgow and Edinburgh, has been hugely successful. It is certainly the case that over the past two centuries, three centuries, the language has declined in Scotland. Much of that is to do with official suppression of the language and the ignorance which generally spread around the language. That has rapidly altered in the past 20 years.
But not everyone shares that positivity about the status of Scottish Gaelic in 2019. Donald William Stewart is a lecturer at Somor Ostig, the Gaelic College on the Isle of Skye.
The situation is pretty desperate, I think, in my view. I first really realised how awful the situation was by going around schools. We used to, I used to be in a theatre company, and we used to go around schools and we visited all the places in the West Highlands where Gaelic was traditionally spoken, and what we saw was a culture which was in really a dreadful state, in many cases a terminal state. Part of the problem is, I think, is that the Highlands is a very diverse area where in some minority language groups you might get everybody living, as it were, in one valley or one very tightly packed place. The Highlands is widely scattered with people living in glens and islands all over the place. So people aren't really taking a notice of what is happening in other communities because they just don't visit these other communities. They aren't aware that this language shift is happening.
But as Gaelic's status as a living language faces arguably its darkest days, it has coincided with something of a renaissance in Gaelic culture. Gaelic speakers now have a dedicated TV and radio service in BBC Alapa. Traditional Gaelic song is also reaching worldwide audiences through the likes of TV drama Outlander and films like Disney's Brave. Gaelic song even featured prominently in the 2019 computer game The Bard's Tale, featuring performances from the likes of Julie Fowlis and Ailie Cormac. So why then, in the face of this cultural resurgence of Gaelic, is the language still in such decline?
There has been undoubtedly a huge increased visibility of the language in the media, and also you're having Gaelic used in institutions, and particularly we've got the efflorescence of Gaelic medium schools where children are being educated in Gaelic. At the same time, however, that might actually cause a problem because people see that Gaelic is being used in what they call higher order domains. They see Gaelic being used on the media. People think, well, you know, I don't really need to make an effort myself. I don't really need to make an effort to teach Gaelic to my children. It's healthy. Of course it's healthy. Look around you. But again, there's a problem between the appearance and the reality.
Given that then, and given the rate of decline in Gaelic speakers here in Scotland, what future is there for Scotland's mother tongue?
We're at a crossroads, I think, in Gaelic at the moment. Is it going to be a language which will still be spoken, but by groups of, if you like, language enthusiasts in the big cities and towns, or will it have some sort of status still in the traditional areas in which it is spoken? I think we, as I said, we really are at this turning point, and I don't think that one community, to be honest, can exist without the other.
Whatever the coming decades hold for Gaelic, if things continue as they are, its future is bleak. Research by the University of the Highlands and Islands, due to be published next year, suggests that the language is on the point of societal collapse. Take a trip to the Western Isles today and you'll still hear Gaelic spoken. Indeed, for many there, it still feels more natural than English. But as younger people move to the big cities, away from that already shrinking community, and without any kind of Scotland-wide investment in resources, passing their language and their heritage on to their own children is becoming increasingly difficult.
There is still time to turn it around, but something needs to be done pretty fast. There's simply not enough money being put towards it, and certainly not enough support at a critical level for it to survive and thrive at the moment.
Of course, the wealth of art and literature in Scots Gaelic means that it'll never truly be gone forever, but its future as a day-to-day, living, breathing language is now, without doubt, hanging in the balance. Jack Foster, DW.
And it's from the northern mountains of Scotland now to the peaks of the Pyrenees, where the Aranese language is spoken by less than 2,000 people. and in just one valley of the mountain range between France and Spain. Oliver Neuroth went to Val d'Aran, the Aran Valley, the homeland of the Aranais, and brings us this report, which is narrated by Natalie Muller.
Lush green fields as far as the eye can see, meandering hiking trails, a stream that turns into a gushing river in summer, and in the distance, mountains, almost 3,000 metres high, their peaks covered in snow. Standing in the Aran Valley in northwestern Catalonia, you could be forgiven for thinking you were in the Alps if it weren't for the fact that most of the tourists here are speaking Spanish and most of the locals communicate in their own unique language. Today is a beautiful day, Monica says in Aranese as she enters a bakery in Vielha, the valley's main town. She speaks her native language almost every day with her family and friends and at work.
It's a cultural treasure for the people here to have their own language. We need to protect this treasure.
The baker José loves it when his customers greet him in Aranese, but it's not a must, he says.
I speak Aranese with everyone from the valley. But if we're being honest, it's just a sub-branch of the Occitan language.
Pero en realidad es Occitan.
Occitan, or Lengua Doc, as it's called by native speakers, is a Romance language mainly spoken in southern France, which borders Spain's Aran Valley. An estimated 1 to 2 million people speak it in their everyday lives. Catalonia is the only region where Occitan has the status of an official language, and since 2006, Aranese has been recognised as an official language there too. But in the Aran Valley, there are only around 1,700 citizens who actually speak Aranese. 10 years ago, that number was 2,300, according to Catalonia's Statistical Institute. Josep Sanz, the head of the Institute of Aranese Studies in Vielha, says part of the reason why Aranese is in decline is immigration. Thousands of people have moved to the valley in recent years because of jobs in the tourist sector. The area is, after all, one of the biggest and most important ski regions in Spain.
Todos estos inmigrantes que llegaron nuevos provenían de países como Sudamérica.
All of these migrants came here from South American countries, Romania or Northern Africa. And of course, they speak different languages. Because of these people, the number of citizens in the valley grew. But the number of people who still speak our language every day drastically declined. A small section of the population, like us, cannot compete with our language against several thousand newcomers.
Un movimiento poblacional tan importante.
Catalonia is trying to promote Aranese, for example, by passing legislation to ensure that the valley's citizens have access to radio and TV stations in their language. At school, children first learn to read and write in Aranese. TV3, Catalonia's regional TV station, has a studio in the city of Vielha, and so does Catalunya Radio. But it's not that easy to find interesting stories here, says TV journalist Jovita Ané. She hosts a TV magazine in Aranese every Friday about the events of the week in the Aran Valley.
It's a small region and the people we interview are always the same. Politicians, administrative representatives. Well, at least we've got some new faces here.
Spain's municipal elections earlier this year brought quite a political change to the Aran Valley, with a swing against separatist parties pushing for Catalonia's independence from Spain. Some residents fear they'll lose out if independence becomes a reality. Pro-independence groups have a majority in Catalonia's regional parliament. Aranese researcher Josep Sanz says he hopes there aren't any drastic political shifts in the near future. Otherwise, that may have consequences for the special status of his language.
Es una lengua con peligros. Es decir,
our language is endangered. If politicians who don't deem our language worthy of protecting are in power, that's a death sentence for Aranese. The same goes for when our language isn't taught in school anymore, or when media outlets no longer report in Aranese.
Sería mortal.
But none of these developments are expected just yet. The current regional government appears committed to promoting Catalan as well as Aranese, and the next local elections aren't due until the end of 2021.
For our final report today, we're going to Babylon in Iraq, home to the Akkadian language. Well, you've never heard of it? That's because it died out about 4,000 years ago, but it was once spoken all across the Middle East, like Arabic is today. Now, just a few fragments written in stone survive today. Babylon was an important economic and cultural center, and it's mentioned in the Torah, the Bible, and the Quran. It has fascinated scholars and scientists over the decades. The magnificent Ishtar Gate, which dates back to Babylonian times, has been reconstructed in a Berlin museum. And I remember how fascinated I was when I first saw the beautiful tiles of that great gate. But of course, the old glory of Babylon is long been destructed, and decades of conflict in modern-day Iraq have not helped. Recently, the ancient city has been declared a UNESCO World Heritage Site. Anna Almeling went to explore, and Neil King has her report.
Makram Mohammed unlocks a heavy iron gate and descends a stone staircase. The tour guide approaches the big old wall and reads the inscriptions on the bricks, translating as he goes.
Dinger, Nabu, Guduri, Osar, the god Nabu protect my dynasty, my family. And this here, Ka Dingra. In Sumerian, Ka Dingra, the gate of the god.
Bulls and mythical creatures stand out among the bricks. Magnificent reliefs depicting ancient deities. They are likely the same beings which decorate the Ishtar Gate in the Pergamon Museum in Berlin. Except these ones aren't coloured. They're the same light brown as the bricks which can be found at the important excavation site. Babylon long captivated researchers and later tourists as well. But then, for a time, all was quiet around the famous ruins as war raged in Iraq. In the meantime, visitors have started to return to Babylon. Ahmed and his girlfriend Zainab look at the old walls with a sense of awe.
This place is important to Iraq. It radiates culture and paints a positive picture of our country. This motivates tourists who come to Iraq and explore the pre-Christian eras and to see how people lived then.
Babylon was founded in the 3rd millennium BC. Little is known about what the original settlement was like during this early time. However, the buildings which emerged by the 6th century BC under the Neo-Babylonian king Nebuchadnezzar II are still partly preserved today. They serve as a testament to the splendor and influence of the Babylonian capital. Makram claps his hands. The sound echoes between the high walls. The walls were reconstructed in the 1970s and 80s under Saddam Hussein's rule. The modern bricks are easily recognizable. Iraq's former leader had his name inscribed on them. He'd wanted to build a palace on an artificial hill he named Saddam Hill. Tour guide Makram has fond memories of this time.
We met Saddam. He even welcomed us and shook hands with us. When a blockade was imposed on Iraq, we helped with the construction. Because as an official back then, you got 2,000 dinars a month, the equivalent of around $2. But as a construction worker, I was paid the same amount per day. So I took unpaid leave and went along. Saddam regularly monitored the construction work, and with every visit we were given a reward.
Today, the huge building towers over Babylon. It remains unused. A group of young scouts from the nearby town of Najaf stroll past and gather around an imposing granite lion. Hazim Al-Kabi accompanies the boys, aged from 10 to 12.
This visit means a lot to us. We stand in solidarity with our history and antiquities, and we support the inclusion of Babylon in the World Heritage List. Our schools and our children should get to know the meaning of Babylon.
In the hot, late summer days, only a few people come to visit Babylon. And with temperatures well over 40 degrees, it's no wonder. In winter, when it cools down, the wide open area invites visitors to stroll down the ancient boulevard, wander through the labyrinth of the old palace walls to the banks of the Euphrates, and explore the barren remains of the Tower of Babel. However, the ancient site isn't equipped to handle large crowds. This should change soon, explains architect Noor Dia.
After Babylon was included on the World Heritage List, we prepared a plan. We have the financial resources to restore the most vulnerable structures, including a path which shows visitors the way to and distance from the ancient buildings.
The buildings and pathways in Babylon are freely accessible, but have already endured a lot. In 2003, the Americans built a military base in Babylon. Makram Mohammed remembers.
When the US soldiers invaded this place, many antiquities were destroyed and stolen. I told them, this is our history, not yours. They arrested me and detained me for 18 days. For 18 days, I didn't see the sun, but it was out of my love for Babylon.
Makram Mohammed grew up in the adjacent village and went to school there. He and two of his brothers have been working as tour guides for over 30 years. When he talks about Babylon, his eyes shine, even after all these years.
Babylon is in the blood in my veins. Babylon is more important to me than my family and my children, because in Babylon, I see what is human, just, and wise. All of the rulers have passed away, but Babylon has remained. When someone asks me for a gift from Babylon, I say, take one of my sons, but not a stone from Babylon.
A report about Babylon in Iraq by Anne Almeling. The presenter was Neil King. And that wraps up our show for this week. If you'd like to listen again to this report or other shows, check out previous episodes of World in Progress. Just go to dw.com/worldinprogress or subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Spotify. Do join me again next week. For today, thanks very much for your interest from all of us in the studio. That's Jan Winkelmann, Gerd Georgi, Eliane Giaducci and me, Anke Rasper. Take care.